versus Woodson, Warden, et cetera, R. Garen Bostic, Petitioners Council, Victoria Johnson, Assistant Attorney General, Respondents Council.
Okay.
You may proceed.
Yeah, but it's full time of the fair box.
There are, I represent Mark Wright. Mr. Wright was originally, is actually before this court based upon an original petition, and that petition is carried to habeas corpus. Under Strickland, there are two different requirements, very commonly referred to as the two prongs. First prong is a performance prong, second prong is a prejudice prong. Now, in my preparations for this case, there's a couple different things I was having a really difficult time getting around. The major issue that is before the court, and court one, two issues really delve into. Was it deficient performance for counsel for the petitioner to agree to a grand larceny from the person instruction as a lesser included offense of robbery? And I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. Up until Friday of last week, I would have had a really, really difficult time standing in front of you and saying, to be honest with you, I'm a trial lawyer. I probably would have done the same thing. Anyhow, I'm a trial lawyer. I've got a case, a federal jury trial scheduled 1 month out. As soon as I'm done with this case, I'm going to go home. I'm going to start looking at the jury instructions for this federal case that's coming up, Western District of Virginia. What is my process when I start going through the preparation for a jury trial? Well, let's keep it simple. The court tells us, this court tells us what to do. So where do I start? Virginia model jury instructions. This is the opening page for the Virginia model jury instructions. Common law robbery is distinguished from common law larceny by the element of force and intimidation which is present in the former and not in the latter. This court, Hudgens v. Commonwealth.
But you may recall Hudgens reversed the in-bank opinion of the Court of Appeals that saw the same issue by a significant margin differently. So it's not one of those black letter maxims that everyone gets smacked around for not knowing. And I was teased by your first remark. I could easily see a defense counsel in a particular trial getting a feel for the jury saying, you know what, I'm going to drop down in semi-nullification, lesser included. It may not be appropriate, but I want that on the table.
And here's the reason why I would disagree with that. When you actually look at the jury instructions, look at the way they're structured. You, the jury, and the jury instructions actually lay it out as the defendant is charged with crime of robbery. The elements of the crime of robbery are, and then it lists out the elements. As it gets to the bottom, the fifth element is by force, threat, or intimidation. The way the jury instruction that I would have read would have been structured would have been the same thing. The way it was set forth in this case was you have found that force, threat, or intimidation was not involved. However, and here's where it jumps out at me right out of the gate. Grand larceny for the person is not a lesser included offense. What is the lesser included offense? So the only thing that would have read on that jury instruction differently was there is no added element of property of $5 or more. The only thing it would have said is larceny instead of grand larceny by $5 or more. So quite frankly, looking at that particular decision, there is no conceivable tactical reason why you would want to give a grand larceny from the person as a lesser included when you've got larceny staring you in the face. These notes tell you that. And I'll tell you this, I went through my next progression.
Before you get too far down the line, what you're saying is that it was a strategic call.
Pardon me.
Are you saying it was a strategic call by the lawyer?
I'm saying it could not have been a strategic call to go with the grand larceny from the person, because the punishment range for that is 20 times that of common law larceny. Common law larceny is up to 12 months in jail.
But it's a whole lot less than robbery.
It's a whole lot less than, well...
And that's what he said. He counts it as a strategic call because robbery carries up to life, which is a whole lot more than larceny from the persons. So he characterized it as strategic. Famous president that used that phrase, strategy. And my question to you is, how can you have strategy about something you admit you don't know?
The whole point that I was making was, the judge has already made a determination that Mr. Graves did not realize that grand larceny in front of the person was a lesser included offense. That act is on page 483 of the index.
He made Graves, that fact. Graves freely admitted that.
Yes, he freely admitted it. So my first point is, you can't make a tactical decision not to give grand larceny in front of the person and not larceny. Just common law larceny.
But the issue is not what might Mr. Graves have done if he was making the motion for a lesser included. It was the Commonwealth that made the motion. And so the issue is, if it were, you said that you could put yourself in his shoes. I could put myself in his shoes. If you or I were there, and we weren't making the motion, we were instead responding to the Commonwealth's motion, and the Commonwealth offers us 0 to 20 instead of 5 to life, you're saying that no attorney would say, oh, yeah, I'm okay with that, Commonwealth.
Well, an attorney that was not committing ineffective assistance counsel would have looked at this book, would have looked at the model jury instructions, and this, and it is simply stated in the annotations, common law robbery, the lesser included, is larceny. And I cannot conceive of any type of a reason why strategically I would want to agree to a grand larceny from the person instruction. When I have because I would have prepared robbery with common law as my lesser included. And that's what I would have submitted. That is what case law says. That's what this court has found on multiple decisions. Of course, we have Hudgens, and we also have looking at the Virginia case law file.
Is it possible for a defense attorney to say, yes, logically, I have a better drop down than the one that's on the table? But that's not going to happen. They're not going to give a misdemeanor in this case. They want something more immediate. I'll leave it where it is. Maybe that's a good call. Maybe that's a bad call. Maybe some attorneys in this context are a little more risk tolerant than they are risk averse. But I mean, isn't that a hypothetical way? I mean,
I can't conceive of doing that for any competent, because what the judge is going to be looking at, what is my lesser included offense? And let me put it another way. Had the government chose to, they could have originally charged robbery and grand larceny from the person. Could have put both of them. And still, you're looking at, you have that possibility. Even on remand, there's a potential, and I don't know what the law would be, and I haven't researched this, they could go back even now and charge him grand larceny from the person.
Is this a fair characterization of your argument? Robbery could be up to a lifetime term, depending on the facts. Who knows how high a jury might recommend on that sort of thing? The defendant was offered a drop down, but there was a better drop down.
And a more legal drop down.
Yeah, a little more legitimate, conceptually.
That is important.
As well as a better, because you're down to a 12 months or less, a misdemeanor.
Correct.
But it's not, I hear you saying to us, that the drop down that was on the table, that was all you had to do is say yes to, nobody would have said no to that. Everybody would have said, no, I want all or nothing. I want to walk out of here with a misdemeanor or nothing. And risk putting the guy in a position of getting a four-year robbery charge.
And here's the problem I have with that. Mr. Graves never discussed any of this with his client. He didn't know what the law was.
Well, I'm not sure a client would figure it out any better than you or me.
You may not have it. You kind of have to tell your client what's going on. And you really need, at the very least, you always start with the model jury instructions. That's what you always do.
When we're here in this court, we start with what the argument was below, and this wasn't it.
For a trial attorney, and we're dealing with professional competence. Was he professionally competent? Did he commit unprofessional errors under Strickland? My position is one of the things you do to be competent is you start with either the code or the model jury instructions, any other relevant treatise. And the Supreme Court has actually touched on this in Hinton versus Alabama.
At some point, do you want to get to the verdict form issue?
I do, in just a second. Let me just say, here's the ultimate point I was actually getting to. An attorney's ignorance of a point of law that is fundamental to his case, combined with his failure to perform basic research on that point, is a quintessential example of unprofessional performance under Strickland. That is, this is exactly what we have here. Is you don't do research, and I cannot conceive of it being professionally competent work when you're not reviewing the very basic stuff that tells you what the law is. Just moving on to the second issue. As to the second issue, really, I think.
One more second.
Yes.
The date of the conviction in your case was what year was that?
2012.
So it was
2012, 2011. Hudges was decided, I believe, 6 or 7 years earlier.
Right.
Then the other cases were, one was Bazemore, 1969, and the other was Jones, 1978.
That's got it. Thank you very much.
With regard to that verdict form, the trial judge has already made a finding of fact that the verdict form in the record is missing a second page. If the second page was somehow lost or destroyed after the jury's verdict was rendered, how do you get over that? I mean, it seems to me it's not an issue.
There's only one argument, and I'll tell you. I thought about this. The only argument that I really think has a lot of validity, and this really goes to both of the points that you wanted information on. Really, the argument that I'm most dealing with is you have to do this stuff in a motion to set aside. We have a motion to set aside for a very particular reason. And you bring, if you're in the heat of the moment and you don't know what the law is, and you go with the grand larceny from the person and you say, okay, and then you miss the jury instruction page, okay. You fix that stuff on a motion to set aside. So that would be my argument there.
Are you going to talk about prejudice?
Excuse me?
Are you going to talk about prejudice?
Well, the prejudice, obviously, if he's convicted of, had the original jury instruction been proper, he could have gotten up to 12 months in jail. That would have been it. He'd be out of jail now. So prejudice, he's been serving a 10-year term on this charge, had the original jury instruction been given properly, then he would have only got up to 12 months in jail. You have automatic prejudice there.
Counsel, if the Commonwealth had moved to amend the indictment for either larceny or grand larceny, what would the objection have been?
If they had moved to amend the indictment, that would have been after a verdict, which it would have been robbery at that point.
If there had been an objection, this is not a lesser included. Commonwealth was okay. I move to amend the indictment. What would have been the objection to amending the indictment?
At what point in the trial?
I just said at the time when they moved to an instruction on the lesser included.
Before the jury got the case.
Oh, before the jury got the case. I don't think you really have an objection to that point.
So where's the prejudice?
I think
where's the prejudice?
Prejudice is when it goes to the jury, when both both the robbery and the grand larceny from the person. You now have that common law larceny, which, if you do it properly, you have grand larceny from...
If he had made the objection, the Commonwealth would have moved to amend the indictment. And you'd be right back where we are, so where's the prejudice?
And the prejudice is, had it gone to the jury as grand larceny from the person, common law larceny would have been a lesser included offense.
Okay, I hear your response. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Victoria Johnson on behalf of the warden. This court should dismiss and deny the petitioner's petition for habeas corpus relief because he has not met his burden to show deficient performance and prejudice as required under Strickland. My understanding of prior argument and of the record is that the trial court, in its remand factual findings, has disposed of the second claim before the court about the incomplete verdict form. So I will rest on my brief on that unless the court has any questions about it and go on to the more substantive claim. Here, the attorney made a reasonable tactical decision. And he admitted, however, that he did not know that grand larceny from a person was not a lesser included offense of robbery at the time when he made his decision. But a mere...
Well, counsel, let me ask you the question that Chief Justice Lemons asked prior to this time. How can someone make a reasonable tactical decision when he or she doesn't know that there was a wrong, based on a wrong theory of the law?
I understand the court's concern on that point, Your Honors. I think that the answer is in some of the cases that I cited to the court. A mistake of law standing alone is not enough to establish deficient performance. Instead, the entire reasonableness of the representation is examined under Strickland. And I think the best example of this is Bullock v. Carver, where an attorney, if that's the Tenth Circuit case that I cited on brief, there, an attorney did not make a meritorious objection to some evidence coming in, and it was damaging evidence. It was evidence of children's reports that his client had sexually abused them. And he could have kept that evidence out and required the children to testify in person, but he didn't because he didn't know that he could make that evidence objection. The Tenth Circuit determined that his performance was not ineffective because, as it turned out, a reasonable, competent defense attorney who was fully informed in the law could have reasonably made the same decision. And it actually worked out better for the client under the Tenth Circuit's reasoning because the defense attorney in Bullock v. Carver was then able to attack the children's testimony in a jury trial without cross-examining the child victims and potentially alienating the jury, which is, in fact, what he did. I think that this
counsel, doesn't that go more to the prejudice issue, and that is that the defendant wasn't prejudiced by virtue of the failure to object?
Well,
because in the end, as you just explained,
he was able to do it well. Well, I think that it goes to both. Certainly, in the end, he was able to take a beneficial course for his client. I agree with that. But Bullock v. Carver also looked at the deficient performance prong, and the Tenth Circuit determined that because you look at the reasonableness of the entire representation, that one mistake of law does not suffice, and a decision made on that mistake of law does not suffice to render performance deficient. And I think that's the same situation we have here.
But here, the point's not whether he knew that grand larceny from the person wasn't a lesser included. If he knew it were a lesser included, he could have demanded that the drop down be put in by the instructions. His judgment call that we were hypothesizing to him is, well, whatever, I got a drop down, that's a lot better than robbery, not as good as a misdemeanor, but who's going to do that in a case like this? So, I mean, the fact that he didn't know that he could have demanded the drop down to grand larceny because of a relatively recent opinion, actually, that contradicted other views of what the law was on that subject for a long time, I'm not seeing how that's relevant to this debate. The question is not could he have insisted upon it, but it's on the table, could he have agreed to it? And
yes, Your Honor, and I think the way the issue was framed for the court by the petitioner, who was acting pro se at the time, was that his attorney was ineffective for failing to object. So that's kind of how I've been approaching it. But going to your point, which I think is more realistic with how trial practice works, here's a defense attorney, you know, the evidence has come in, it's not great, two motions to strike have been denied, and the Commonwealth says, hey, we can do grand larceny from a person. I don't think any reasonable defense attorney would turn that down. And sure, he could have asked for the petit larceny, as Wright is argued now.
Was that theory argued below?
No.
That the real error here is not agreeing to the grand larceny from the person, but rather insisting upon a common law misdemeanor larceny.
No, that was never argued below.
So what do you mean argued below?
Well, I guess not below. Argued in the petition or on remand.
Sorry, yes. So it's not part of the pleadings of the case?
That's correct. And neither is the motion to set aside issue. I believe that arose first at the remand hearing.
Well, counsel, if we adopt your view of what is not ineffective assistance of counsel, in other words, not knowing what the law is and going along with something, and then, whoops, all of a sudden that makes the conviction illegal, which would be on direct appeal, I realize, which was raised on this in the case on direct appeal but not addressed. Aren't we condoning legal strategy that allows even intentional ignorance of the law to then come back and be a grounds for appeal? Say, well, I should get off this case. I mean, I should get my conviction reversed because it was not a lesser included offense.
I understand your question, Your Honor, and my short answer is no. And that is because there are various appellate doctrines, of course, that protect against that kind of result, such as aggravate, reprobate, invited error, things like that. And as far as allowing intentional attorney ignorance to try to kind of game the system, for lack of a better term, I think that sort of thing would wash out in a habeas proceeding, whereas here we had an evidentiary hearing where we can take evidence on the issue and find out, have a trier of fact look at the attorney and determine his credibility and find out what he was doing.
Excuse me, but in this case, the attorney said, well, even if I knew that I was, that wasn't a lesser included offense, I'd go ahead anyway and let him be convicted of a crime that he shouldn't be convicted of.
And I submit that's not an improper use of an attorney's.
So so on habeas, we can kind of overlook that, but on a direct appeal, we couldn't. Is that what you're telling me?
No, Your Honor, it's not. I think under New York v. Hill, which I think I probably cited in my brief, but I can't recall at this moment, but in New York v. Hill, which is a United States Supreme Court case that discusses in a habeas context, what decisions are for the client and what decisions are for counsel. Really, once you're represented by counsel, there's a lot of stuff that an attorney can waive, like speedy trial for setting a hearing, and things like that. And really, the only thing that the client has a specific say about is whether to plead guilty or some other very narrow issues, like whether to appeal. But here, the attorney was offered a benefit to his client, and he knew it was a benefit to his client. And I think any reasonable, competent defense attorney would, in furtherance of protecting his client, accept that. Because maybe he read the room, and they said he could get anything lower. Maybe he'd read the room and thought, my client's going to go to jail for a really long time on a violent felony of robbery when he could just be convicted of a theft crime.
But if he knew the law, as Justice Mims suggested, he could have asked for an indictment, amendment of the indictment, and get a conviction under that, which he wanted.
And he could have, and that takes us right to the prejudice prong, which, of course, is what the petitioner bears the burden to prove both. And, of course, if he had gotten a conviction based on an amendment, it would be the same conviction. So there the petitioner would fail on prejudice.
There's a certain irony, too, to the to Mr. Lego, because if he'd gone to the trial and the prosecution put Larson from the first on the table was a drop down, and he said, no, no, I've seen the debate between the Court of Appeals and the Virginia Supreme Court, and the Virginia Supreme Court won that debate, it's technically not very narrow reason, technically not a drop down. Lesser included finding.
Do we need to hear on that claim, Your Honor?
And gets convicted and gets 20 years on robbery, 25 years on robbery, and not suspended. It would be, why didn't you take the chance? It's something better than what the guy got hit with.
When the Commonwealth attorney gave it to you on a silver platter, why did you walk away from that opportunity I would have had, the client would have had, to get a lesser, you know, a shot at something instead of nothing or, you know, this long sentence for robbery. So I think that's where ineffective assistance of counsel for a deficient performance is a very practical inquiry. And it really involves taking the record as the attorney kind of knew it when he was making that decision. And here, even if he testified to this at the evidentiary hearing, here, even if the attorney had known that it was not a lesser included, he said, I would have been happy to get that in front of the jury any day of the week, the way this case was going.
Can I confirm one last thing to make absolutely sure I didn't misunderstand the evidentiary hearing? The theory that the attorney should have gone for the misdemeanor drop-down, was that ever mentioned, much less decided or addressed or testified to in the evidentiary hearing?
No, it was not. That is a new argument here today. And I would submit it's not properly before the court because it wasn't planned in the petition.
Are you going to address prejudice?
Yes, sir. I would very much like to. Just briefly, because I think that we've addressed a little bit already in discussion. Had the proper objection been made, one or two things would have happened. The Commonwealth would have moved to amend. In likelihood, the Commonwealth would have moved to amend the indictment, and we would be at grand larceny from the person, which is where we are now. Or the Commonwealth would have just withdrawn the instruction. And while there is always a possibility that a jury will acquit someone, when we are looking at habeas review, you know, the law cited in my brief, and petitioner is not entitled to looking at through a capricious fact finder or whimsy or nullification or anything like that. Instead, you have to look at the sufficiency of the evidence. And here the evidence was legally sufficient to support, could have supported a robbery conviction in the absence of anything else. So there was a strong chance that the defendant would have been convicted of a greater offense, a robbery offense, and in this scenario, the attorney, although he was admittedly ignorant on a point of law, was acting as counsel and trying to protect his client from that result. And for those reasons, I think...
Well, now, that suggested lesser included came from the Commonwealth, didn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, and so by not objecting to it, he was taking advantage of that.
Well,
I'm so sorry, Your Honor.
I don't see anything wrong with a defense attorney. I mean, you could have brought it all the way down to littering, and if that's the Commonwealth wanted to have that as a lesser included, as a defense attorney, I probably would have said, "Well, go for it." I mean, but I see that's the dilemma that I have with the case. His actual response was that it was strategic. Well, it couldn't have been strategic. It couldn't possibly have been, he didn't even know it. That, and the argument that I just made, but no, I didn't know whether it was or not, but it carried a whole lot less time, and that's what I wanted to go for, it didn't matter to me.
And I think that's what Mr. Graves, the attorney, testified to pretty much at the hearing. You know, he didn't know at the time, but if he had known, you know, whatever, as long as my client had less sentencing exposure, I was happy to have that from the Commonwealth.
What he didn't know is he had a right to it.
Yes, Your Honor.
His strategy was, I want a drop down, and as Chief mentions, you would think any defense attorney would be thinking, all right, well, any drop down you give me is good. He didn't appreciate the fact that he could have demanded the drop down.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's
up to the misdemeanor charge.
To the misdemeanor charge.
And he didn't have a right to demand the drop down that the prosecutor was given.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. I think that's a fair summary of the record and Mr. Gray's testimony. So let's recalculate
this, or at least recap it. The argument that he didn't go all the way down to the misdemeanor was never presented.
That's correct, Your Honor.
In this case. The argument, well, I didn't know that it wasn't a lesser included offense, but I knew it was a whole lot better than life in prison.
Yes.
Was presented in this.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the question on that is it ineffective assistance of counsel for the lawyer to say, well, I'm going to accept this. I don't know whether it's a lesser included, but I do know it's less than life. That has been argued in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, now, is that ineffective assistance of counsel?
My time has expired.
No, it hasn't. I'm still asking you questions.
No, Your Honor, that is not ineffective assistance of counsel because his strategy was that,
if that's the case, then haven't you just conceded this?
I'm sorry?
Excuse me. I'm sorry. It's the other way around.
Yes, Your Honor.
Completely the other way around with the argument that he didn't make in this case. I'm sorry. You're right.
Yes, Your Honor. So my position is that there was not ineffective assistance of counsel in this case. The petitioner has not proved deficient performance or prejudice as he must under Strickland, and that this petition should be denied.
All right. Rebuttal?
One of the things I neglected to say, and I'm going to tell you, I actually had it as part of my initial script. When I came up with this, and what I thought one of you would ask me is, if you had the opportunity to get that lesser included instruction of grand larceny from the person, would you take it? You know what? 9 times out of 10, as trial counsel, I would. As of last Friday, I would have taken it. Saturday is when it hit. Look at it from a trial counsel standpoint. Do what we do, and that's when it hit.
Well, but the mere fact that 9 out of 10 times you would have taken it, doesn't that indicate that it wouldn't be ineffective for somebody else to take it?
Right. If I'm just talking about in general of a lesser included offense.
Right.
But I would have had to have looked at, in this case, what I wanted to do is go back and find out what the law is. Because 9 times out of 10, what I'm dealing with, grand larceny or petty larceny, distribution or possession of food. You know, those type of lesser included offenses. And most of the time, you're always going to be asking for the lesser included. This case, it just came to me Saturday, literally. Let's go back and look at it from a trial counsel standpoint.
All right, the court will be in recess till 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All right.